Chapter 4. Reeked with heat and vapors, so that lassitude fell on the hermit also, and he could hardly drag himself down to the spring, whence he drew his drinking water. Thus he fell into the habit of going down to the glen before cockcrow, after he had recited matins, for at that hour the rain commonly ceased, and a faint air was stirring. Now because of the wet season the stream had not gone dry, and instead of replenishing his flagon slowly at the trickling spring, the hermit went down to the waterside to fill it. And once, as he descended the steep slope of the glen, he heard the covert rustle, and saw the leaves stir, as though something moved behind them. As he looked, silence fell, and the leaves grew still. But his heart was shaken, for it seemed to him that what he had seen in the dusk had a human semblance, such as the wood people wear. And he was loth to think that such unhallowed beings haunted the glen. A few days passed, and again, descending to the stream, he saw a figure flit by him through the covert, and this time a deeper fear entered into him. But he put away the thought, and prayed fervently for all souls in temptation. And when he spoke with the wild woman again, on the feast of the seven Maccabees, which falls on the first day of August, he was smitten with fear, to see her wasted looks, and besought her to cease from laboring, and let him minister to her in her weakness. But she denied him gently, and replied that all she asked of him was to keep her steadfastly in his prayers. Before the feast of the Assumption the rain ceased, and the plague, which had begun to show itself, was stayed. But the ardency of the sun grew greater, and the hermit's cliff was a fiery furnace. Never had such heat been known in those regions, but the people did not murmur, for with the cessation of the rain their crops were saved, and the pestilence banished. And these mercies they ascribed in great part to the prayers and macerations of the two holy anchorets. Therefore on the eve of the Assumption they sent a messenger to the hermit, saying that at daylight on the morrow the townspeople, and all the dwellers in the valley would come forth, led by their bishop, who bore the Pope's blessing to the two solitaries, and who was mindful to celebrate the Mass of the Assumption in the hermit's cave in the cliffside. At the blessed word the hermit was well nigh distraught with joy, for he felt this to be a sign from heaven, that his prayers were heard, and that he had won the wild woman's grace as well as his own. And all night he prayed that on the morrow she might confess her fault, and receive the sacrament with him. Before dawn he recited the psalms of the proper nocturne. Then he girded on his gown and sandals, and went forth to meet the bishop in the valley. As he went downward daylight stood on the mountains, and he thought he had never seen so fair a dawn. It filled the farthest heaven with brightness, and penetrated even to the woody crevices of the glen, as the grace of God had entered into the obscurest folds of his heart. The morning airs were hushed, and he heard only the sound of his own footfall, and the murmur of the stream which, though diminished, still poured a swift current between the rocks. But as he reached the bottom of the glen a sound of chanting came to him, and he knew that the pilgrims were at hand. His heart leapt up and his feet hastened forward. But at the stream side they were suddenly stayed, for in a pool, where the water was still deep, he saw the shining of a woman's body, and on a stone hard by lay the wild woman's gown and sandals. Fear and rage possessed the hermit's heart, and he stood as one smitten speechless, covering his eyes from the shame. But the song of the approaching pilgrim swelled ever louder and nearer, and finding voice he cried to the wild woman to come forth, and hide herself from the people. She made no answer, but in the dusk he saw her limbs sway with the swaying of the water, and her eyes were turned to him, as if in mockery. At the sight blind fury filled him, and clambering over the rocks to the pool's edge he bent down, and caught her by the shoulder. At that moment he could have strangled her with his hands, so abhorrent to him was the touch of her flesh. But as he cried out on her, heaping her with cruel names, he saw that her eyes returned his look without wavering, and suddenly it came to him that she was dead. Then through all his anger and fear a great pang smote him, for here was his work undone, and one he had loved in Christ laid low in her sin, in spite of all his labors. One moment pity possessed him, the next he bethed him, how the people would find him bending above the body of a naked woman, whom he had held up to them as holy, but whom they might now well take for the secret instrument of his undoing, and beholding how at her touch all the slow edifice of his holiness was demolished, and his soul in mortal jeopardy, he felt the earth reel round him, and his sight grew red. Already the head of the procession had entered the glen, and the stillness shook with the great sound of the Savagina. When the hermit opened his eyes once more, the air was quivering with thronged candle flames, which glittered on the gold thread of priestly vestments, and on the blazing monstrance beneath its canopy, and close above him was bent the bishop's face. The hermit struggled to his knees. "My Father in God," he cried, "behold, for my sins I have been visited by a demon," but as he spoke he perceived that those about him no longer heeded him, and that the bishop and all his clergy had fallen on their knees about the pool. Then the hermit, following their gaze, saw that the brown waters of the pool covered the wild woman's limbs, as with a garment, and that about her floating head a great light floated, and to the utmost edges of the throng a cry of praise went up, for many were there whom the wild woman had healed and comforted, and who read God's mercy in this wonder. But fresh fear fell on the hermit, for he had cursed a dying saint, and denounced her aloud to all the people, and this new anguish, coming so close upon the other, smote down his weakened frame, so that his limbs failed him, and he sank once more to the ground. Again the earth reeled about him, and the bending faces grew remote, but as he forced his weak voice once more to proclaim his sins he felt the blessed touch of absolution, and the holy oils of the last voyage laid on his lips and eyes. Peace returned to him then, and with it a great longing to look once more upon his laws, as he had dreamed of doing at his last hour, but he was too far gone to make this longing known, and so tried to banish it from his mind. Yet in his weakness the wish held him, and the tears ran down his face. Then, as he lay there, feeling the earth slip from under him, and the everlasting arms replace it, he heard a great peal of voices, that seemed to come down from the sky and mingle with the singing of the throng, and the words of the chant were the words of his own laws, so long hidden in the secret of his breast, and now rejoicing above him through the spheres. And his soul rose on the chant, and soared with it to the seat of mercy. "The last asset, I, the devil," Paul Garnet exclaimed as he reread his note, and the dry old gentleman who was at the moment his only neighbor in the quiet restaurant they both frequented, remarked with a smile, "Colin, you don't seem particularly annoyed at meeting him." Garnet returned the smile. I don't know why I apostrophized him, for he's not in the least present except inasmuch as he may prove to be at the bottom of anything unexpected." The old gentleman who, like Garnet, was an American, and spoke in the thin rarefied voice which seems best fitted to emit sententious truths, twisted his lean neck toward the younger man, and cackled out shrewdly, "Colin, it's generally a woman who is at the bottom of the unexpected. Not," he added, leaning forward with deliberation, "to select a toothpick, that precludes the devil's being there too." Garnet uttered the requisite laugh, and his neighbor, pushing back his plate, called out with a perfectly unbending American intonation, "Colin, gas song. Ladition, silver play." His repast, as usual, had been a simple one, and he left only 30 centimes in the plate on which his account was presented. But the waiter, to whom he was evidently a familiar presence, received the tribute with Latin affability, and hovered helpfully about the table, while the old gentleman cut and lighted his cigar. "Yes," the latter proceeded, revolving the cigar meditatively between his thin lips, "they're generally both in the same hole, like the owl and the prairie dog in the natural history books of my youth. I believe it was all a mistake about the owl and the prairie dog, but it isn't about the unexpected. The fact is, the unexpected is the devil. The sooner you find that out, the happier you'll be." He leaned back, tilting his smooth bald head against the blotched mirror behind him, and rambling on with gentle garrulity, while Garnet attacked his omelet. Get your life down to a routine, eliminate surprises. Arrange things so that, when you get up in the morning, you'll know exactly what is going to happen to you during the day, and the next day and the next. I don't say it's funny, it ain't. But it's better than being hit on the head by a brickbat. That's why I always take my meals at this restaurant. I know just how much onion they put in things. If I went to the next place, I shouldn't. And I always take the same streets. To come here, I've been doing it for 10 years now. I know at which crossings to look out. I know what I'm going to see in the shop windows. It saves a lot of wear and tear to know what's coming. For a good many years I never did know, from one minute to another, and now I like to think that everything's cut and dried, and nothing unexpected can jump out at me like a tramp from a ditch. He paused calmly to knock the ashes from his cigar, and Garnet said with a smile, "Colin, doesn't such a plan of life cut off nearly all the possibilities?" The old gentleman made a contemptuous motion. The possibilities of what? Of being multifariously miserable? There are lots of ways of being miserable, but there's only one way of being comfortable, and that is to stop running round after happiness. If you make up your mind not to be happy, there's no reason why you shouldn't have a fairly good time. That was Schopenhauer's idea, I believe, the young man said, pouring his wine with a smile of youthful incredulity. I guess he hadn't the monopoly, responded his friend. Lots of people have found out the secret. The trouble is that so few live up to it. He rose from his seat, pushing the table forward, and standing passive while the waiter advanced with his shabby overcoat and umbrella. Then he nodded to Garnet, lifted his hat politely to the broad-bosomed lady behind the desk, and passed out into the street. Garnet looked after him with a musing smile. The two had exchanged views on life for 2 years without so much as knowing each other's names. Garnet was a newspaper correspondent whose work kept him mainly in London, but on his periodic visits to Paris he lodged in a dingy hotel of the Latin Quarter, the chief merit of which was its nearness to the cheap and excellent restaurant, where the two Americans had made acquaintance. But Garnet's assiduity in frequenting the place arose, in the end, less from the excellence of the food than from the enjoyment of his old friend's conversation. Amid the flashy sophistications of the Parisian life to which Garnet's trade introduced him, the American sage's conversation had the crisp and homely flavor of a native dish, one of the domestic compounds for which the exiled palate is supposed to yearn. It was a mark of the old man's impersonality that, in spite of the interest he inspired, Garnet had never got beyond idly wondering who he might be, where he lived, and what his occupations were. He was presumably a bachelor, a man of family ties, however relaxed, though he might have been as often absent from home, would not have been as regularly present in the same place, and there was about him a boundless desultoriness which renewed Garnet's conviction that there is no one on earth as idle as an American who is not busy. From certain allusions it was plain that he had lived many years in Paris, yet he had not taken the trouble to adapt his tongue to the local inflections, but spoke French with the accent of one who has formed his conception of the language from a phrase book. The city itself seemed to have made as little impression on him as its speech. He appeared to have no artistic or intellectual curiosities, to remain untouched by the complex appeal of Paris, while preserving, perhaps the more strikingly from his very detachment, that odd American astuteness which seems the fruit of innocence, rather than of experience. His nationality revealed itself again in a mild interest in the political problems of his adopted country, though they appeared to preoccupy him only as illustrating the boundless perversity of mankind. The exhibition of human folly never ceased to divert him, and though his examples of it seemed mainly drawn from the columns of one exiguous daily paper, he found there matter for endless variations on his favorite theme. If this monotony of topic did not weary the younger man, it was because he fancied he could detect under it the tragic implication of the fixed idea of some great moral upheaval which had flung his friend stripped and starving on the desert island of the little cafe where they met. He hardly knew wherein he read this revelation, whether in the resigned shabbiness of the sage's dress, the impartial courtesy of his manner, or the shade of apprehension which lurked, indescribably, in his guileless yet suspicious eye. There were moments when Garnet could only define him by saying that he looked like a man who had seen a ghost. 2. An apparition almost as startling had come to Garnet himself in the shape of the mauve note received from his concierge as he was leaving the hotel for luncheon. Not that, on the face of it, a missive announcing Mrs. Sam Newell's arrival at Ritz's, and her need of his presence there that afternoon at 5, carried any special mark of the portentous. It was not her being at Ritz's that surprised him. The fact that she was chronically hard up, and had once or twice lately been so brutally confronted with the consequences, as to accept indeed solicit a loan of £5 from him. This circumstance, as Garnet knew, would never be allowed to affect the general tenor of her existence. If one came to Paris, where could one go but to Ritz's? Did he see her in some grubby hole across the river? Or in a family pension near the Place de l'Étoile? There was no affectation in her tendency to gravitate toward what was costliest and most conspicuous. In doing so, she obeyed one of the profoundest instincts of her nature, and it was another instinct which taught her to gratify the first at any cost, even to that of dipping into the pocket of an impecunious newspaper correspondent. It was a part of her strength, and of her charm too, that she did such things naturally, openly, without any of the ugly grimaces of dissimulation or compunction. Her recourse to Garnet had of course marked a specially low ebb in her fortunes. Save in moments of exceptional dearth, as he had richer sources of supply, and he was nearly sure that, by running over the society column of the Paris Herald, he should find an Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.